If I were to ask you to tell me stereotypes that people have of Baptists who live in the South, what would be some of your answers to popular common stereotypes about Baptists? Not necessarily by Baptists, but by other people.
Fire and brimstone.
Fire and brimstone. Good. Huh? Backwards. Good, huh?
Narrow-minded.
No dancing.
No dancing. And that's just the first of a list of 9,312 things you can't do.
Teetotalers.
Okay, can't go swimming together. Teetotaling. No women in positions of leadership. Good. You can understand why in the first session I talked about a lot of Baptist churches that are dropping Baptist out of their name.
Yeah.
If you put the stereotypes with the reaction of the church that says, we don't even have a chance to reach an awful lot of people because they already have these stereotypes of us. Let me tell you a story. Darnie and I were down to see a dear friend of ours who's a writer in Monroeville this past week. And while we were there, she's having some memory problems, and I told her a story that I thought would amuse her. And I said, first name is Nell, but her second name is Harper, and our daughter is named in her honor, Harper. And so I said, Darty and I were in Seattle a few years ago, and I took my granddaughter, who was at that time 6, to a park on the top of the mountain where they live. And there was a young woman, half my age, who had her daughter there, who looked to be about the same age. So there was this long bench, and the only bench there, this long bench, and she was sitting on that end. So because there was no one else at the park at all, I thought, well, maybe I'll just sit on the other end of the bench. So I did. And being from the South, I wanted to say, where do you come from? What do you do? Is this your only daughter? But I thought, you know, this might not be appropriate in an isolated park where there are only 2 children and 2 adults and both the children very young. So I just kept my mouth shut and read my book. And as I was reading the book, she said, Harper, you stop that right now. Well, since my granddaughter's named Harper and I didn't know what her granddaughter was named, I immediately assumed that this uppity Yankee was correcting my granddaughter, which I did not at all appreciate. And so I said, I was just about to say, mind your own business, when in fact she looked at her granddaughter and her granddaughter ran over to her, or her daughter ran over to her. And I realized her daughter was named Harper, like my granddaughter was named Harper. And so when the 2 kids went off and played amicably together and happily together for some time, I said, your daughter's named Harper. And she said, yes. One word answer. And I said, I was wanting more than that. I was wanting a conversation, but she said, yes. And I said, my granddaughter is named Harper too. At which I got this look of total disbelief, as if you dirty old man. And I thought, just be quiet, Wayne. And so I returned to my reading. But then the devil made me do this. And I said, is your daughter named for a writer? And she said, yes, my daughter is named for my favorite writer. At which point I wanted to say, well, your favorite writer is one of our dearest friends. And could I tell you about your favorite writer? And then I thought, you know, if you say one more word to her, she's going to call 911 and have you arrested. And I told Harper this story, and she just chortled. She was doubled over with glee and delight at this. And my wife, who was transitioning to a different conversation, said, and you, a Baptist preacher? To which Harper responded, you're too intelligent to be a Baptist. And I'm going to tell you how we got that stereotype. And why that stereotype, obviously, is badly mistaken, and our new pastor would be a good example, if he's called, of why that's so badly mistaken. Back in the early part of the 19th century, when Alabama was just an infant state, people poured in this place, part of the great stream of immigrants pouring into America from all over the world, and part of the great stream of poor people just coming further and further south and west, until finally they wound up on the Alabama frontier. And it was a wild place, as I suggested last week. There was a lot of violence, a huge amount of alcoholism and drinking, for which the Alabama frontier was famous. There were eye gouging matches where men actually gouged out each other's eyes, and there were knife fights and gunfights. And Alabama is actually, no matter what you think of it now, a pretty civilized place compared to what it was in those days. But then in the years that followed, what was called Alabama Fever, this great tidal wave of immigration that poured into Alabama when we were sort of the hottest story in the American nation, things began to change. And more people began to receive some sort of education. Schools began. By 1854, we had a state school act, and we had public schools open. And people were going to colleges. Judson had been opened for Baptist women in 1839, and Howard College, my alma mater, in 1842. And Southern College, which became Birmingham Southern, all opened within a radius of 30 miles of each other down in the Perry-Hale County area. And the place became fairly civilized. Now, in the trough between these two periods, the 1820s and 30s, when people were pouring in, and it was just a wild frontier, and the time that it became fairly civilized in the 1850s, some things happened. For one thing, Baptists and Methodists played a major role in bringing order and stability to the Alabama frontier by their revivals. And their revivals were known to be shockingly emotional. And in fact, we have here the first real definition of Baptist principles, because for many people, Baptist was more about your heart than your head. It was a religion of the heart. And I brought my Alabama Baptist book, a book that I worked on for about 35 years, and finally decided that if I didn't write it immediately and get done with it, that I would become a Presbyterian. So I have a passage in there that talks about the revivals of 1832, and a famous pastor who described one of the revivals of 1832. Strong men fell upon the ground, apparently helpless, lying there for hours, so powerful was the reaction of soul upon their body. When they began to hope in Christ, they would rise up and often soberly join in the singing. Hosea Holcomb, one of the first great Baptist historians of Alabama, also talking about the 1832 revivals, remembered one that started in 1831 and lasted a year. Now, that is what I call a rip-roaring revival. Started in 1831, ended in 1832, and he said that the groans and cries of repenting sinners, the songs and prayers, the shouts and praises of Christians form an awful yet delightful harmony. During that year, they baptized 500 people in that church. And that was just one church on a frontier, literally alive, like an ant bed, with Baptist and Methodist revivalists who were preaching from one end of the state to the other. But by the 1840s, something really strange had happened. Not only had the revival period pretty much burned itself out and tens of thousands had been converted, but in addition to that, lots of well-educated people, and I'm going to talk about this in the term of the Auburn First Baptist Church in just a minute, because a lot of new families come in from Georgia and the Carolinas, and many of them actually had college degrees and some significant education. So right about the 1840s, I say, increasing worldly status and success eroded the emotional fervor of Baptist revivalism. Intense debate erupted among Baptists over the efficacy of count revivals and protracted meetings because of the excesses often associated with them. By 1840, Hosea Holcomb, who has himself preached in the revival of 1831-32, conceded that many churches are now disapproving of the meetings with all of their screams, cries, groans, shouts, notes of grief, and notes of joy all heard at the same time, which make much confusion, a sort of indescribable concert. And he even notes one meeting at which five Baptist preachers, and I can't imagine who would have put together a meeting with five different Baptist preachers at the same time, but he did. And they were having a service, and all five preachers began to pray and preach at the same time. I shouldn't say all five, four of the five. And finally, they noted that one of the brethren had not begun to pray or preach and said, "Why do you not unite with us and pray with us?" To which the preacher responded, "I have been endeavoring to pray for some time that the Lord would be pleased to forgive you for your disorderly conduct." Holcomb, the great First Baptist historian in Alabama, commented at the end of this report about the five preachers that such meetings produce much good wheat among a considerable quantity of chaff. And that's probably a pretty good description of the attitude of First Baptist Church, Auburn. They had revivals, they had great revivals, they were great in-gathering revivals, but by the 1840s and 50s, as more and more people in Auburn became richer and richer from the cotton trade, they became more and more embarrassed by the excesses of emotionalism. So by the 1850s, you began to get, you note a difference in the kind of pastors who were pastoring churches like Auburn First Baptist. They had been folksy, poorly educated people in the 1830s and 40s. By the 1850s, they were looking for a new kind of pastor. Sometimes times were hard and they couldn't get the one they wanted, and they had to take the one they could get. But nonetheless, they're looking for new kind of pastors. This was occurring in the context of a revolution in Alabama. If you think of it as two streams coming together to form one river, think of it in terms of the European Baptist tradition of rationalism, of theology, of writing books and writing sermons and preaching for 2 hours from a manuscript, compared to the Alabama frontier I've just described, made up of bivocational ministers with no formal theological training whatsoever, even the brightest of them for the most part, self-educated for the most part, and full of emotional hellfire and damnation kind of theology. Now, if you think of these two streams coming together, let me sort of show you the different places where they're coming together. Up here in the Tennessee Valley, which was one of the two first areas settled in Alabama, Mobile and the French and Spanish being first, and the Tennessee Valley spilling over from Appalachian, mainly Scotch and Welsh, of farmers who were coming from Europe, and there was no land for them on the eastern seaboard, so they go out to the frontier. They can't get beyond the Indians west of the Appalachian Mountains, so they come straight down the mountains. As I said last week, they settled the Tennessee Valley, and they thought they'd gotten to heaven because that rich alluvial land that had overspread the area where Bob Stevenson is from gave them a kind of land for which cotton could not have been better. So they began to grow cotton. By 1820, 3% of all the cotton grown in the United States was grown in the Tennessee Valley. And the farmers in Virginia and the Carolinas were wearing out the land there because they had overused it and they had not fertilized it properly. And so the land was worn out, and they're heading down through the Carolinas into central Alabama after the Treaty of Fort Jackson in December of 1815, when everything in Alabama west of the Coosa River is opened. And then in 1836, after everything east of the Coosa River is opened, that's the last area to be settled. That's where we are. And remember, last week I told you 4 years after the creeks were forcibly removed from this part of Alabama, Auburn First Baptist Church was founded. 4 years. So, I mean, this is boom time in Auburn. People are pouring in because this is the easternmost edge of the Alabama Black Belt. And the Alabama Black Belt was like going to heaven in the 1830s, just like the Tennessee Valley had been earlier. To show you the transformation, people who lived in log cabins in the 1830s were living at places like Noble Hall in the 1850s. The great Greek Revival mansions of the Black Belt all the way from Auburn down to Eufaula, and from Eufaula straight through Montgomery and over to Demopolis and through Perry County and Hale County. Just get in your car and drive. That's the world that cotton built in the 1850s. For instance, by 1849, the last year of the 1850 census, 23% of all the cotton grown in the United States was grown in Alabama. Got that? 23% of all the cotton grown in America was grown in Alabama. Only 10% of the Mississippi Delta had even been cleared for cultivation. The Black Belt land had just been brought into cultivation. It was so incredibly productive, people couldn't believe it. And you're thinking, well, I mean, yeah, but there are all these other things that are being made and grown in America. Did you realize that in the 1860 census, 50% of all U.S. exports consisted of one product, cotton? Think about that. Think about, of all the things America sells to the rest of the world, half of it is cotton. And nearly one quarter of that's grown in Alabama. And you have some idea, when people talk about the cotton kingdom, just how much king it was. Well, as that wealth increases, think of it in this way. Alabama produced 500,000 bales of cotton in 1850 and nearly 1 million bales of cotton in 1860. And all of a sudden, you begin to understand the wealth that's being created. And like I say, if you need any additional evidence of that, just drive through the Alabama Black Belt, get off Highway 80, and just wander around the roads and look at the mansions that were built by that great prosperity. Therefore, if you begin to look at the Tennessee Valley, you've got a fairly prosperous cotton-oriented area, but now, whereas this area was producing 67% of Alabama's cotton in 1820, it's producing about 5% of Alabama's cotton by 1849, because it's all right through here, right through from Auburn straight over to Demopolis. And in that area, you begin to get all of these schools. Think about East Alabama Methodist Institute, but you can also think about the girls' school that preceded that, or you can think about Southern, now Birmingham Southern College, or you can think about Judson, or you can think about Howard, or you can think about any number of academies, because the Baptists and the Methodists and the Presbyterians and the Episcopalians all through this area now believed educating your child, male and female, was the right and godly thing to do. And you wanted a preacher who himself had that kind of education, because you didn't want your children to look at the preacher and be offended by the fact that you were Baptist. You wanted them to be proud of it. And since they were going to school and they were going to college, you wanted a pastor in the same category. So all of a sudden, there is this shattering kind of change from what you wanted Baptist to be stereotyped as being like, and what your pastor would be like. And so all of a sudden, we have four basic patterns emerging in Auburn and in the Black Belt. And incidentally, this is not altogether true of the Hill Country, where there are very few educated people and very few educated pastors. And we're looking at a state where a very significant number of whites were no more than functionally literate. And that was especially true in the isolated and very poor mountain counties north of Shelby County. So from Shelby County to the Tennessee Valley, what you find are almost no schools, very little literacy, and people who are subsistence farmers, and they're mainly growing corn and they're making whiskey. Because since there was a tax on whiskey, if you sold moonshine, you didn't have to pay the tax and you kept all the money yourself. And there were a lot of Baptist preachers who, in fact, were helping their people market their whiskey because that was the only source of income for many of these people. They couldn't grow cotton because the land was terrible. And besides that, what are you going to do with it when you grow it? The only way to get cotton to market was by wagon. And you're talking about hills and deep valleys. And a cotton bale weighs 500 pounds. So how are you going to get a cotton bale from where it was to where it wasn't? And that's a major problem. Keep in mind also that by this period, by the 1850s, Mobile is the third largest port in the United States. New York is number one, New Orleans is number two, Mobile is number three, and in the 1820s, Apalachicola, Florida, which drains the Chattahoochee Valley, is number four. And that's all because of cotton being grown in Alabama and shipped either on the Tennessee River up to the Ohio River, on the Ohio River down the Mississippi River to New Orleans. So New Orleans is a cotton port for North Alabama, which is incidentally the reason that area didn't want to secede, because if they secede and the Union controls the Ohio River, they ain't going to sell any cotton from that point on. And even if the war had been settled without fighting, Ohio would have been a Yankee state, and they couldn't have shipped the cotton. So probably Tennessee Valley would have seceded from Alabama if there hadn't been a civil war. Okay, and of course, Mobile is draining the Alabama River, and Apalachicola is draining the Chattahoochee River. And in Alabama, all of a sudden, this has become a religion of the head and the heart, not just the heart. So no matter what stereotype Harper Lee has of me, there are an awful lot of civilized and fairly intelligent people who are Baptist and have been for almost 200 years now. Secondly, this religion is extremely democratic. It's not like we were the only game in town during these years. There were Episcopalians who came in and they started churches. There were Presbyterians. They came in and they started churches. There were Restorationists, Church of Christ people. They started churches. And there were Methodists and Baptists. But the Methodists and Baptists were the most emotional and the most democratic. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the numbers, by 1823, when the Alabama Baptist Convention was formed, there were only 5,000 Baptists, black and white, in the entire state. When the Alabama Methodist Conference was formed 9 years later in 1831, there were 11,000 Methodists, so roughly twice as many Methodists as Baptists. And the Methodists, as reflected in what happened in Auburn, where the Methodists ran everything, and the Baptist church was just the little so afterthought church, and all the wealthy people and powerful people were Methodist. By 1860, all of that had changed. And all those revivals had basically converted the frontier into either Methodist or Baptist, but now Baptists have 65,000 members and Methodists have 60,000 members. We had finally overtaken and passed the Methodists, and we never looked back. There are now 4.8 million people in the state of Alabama, and there are 1 million Southern Baptists, and there are nearly a million additional Baptists of various other kinds, primitive Baptists, African-American Baptists in multiple denominations, free will Baptists, two seeds in the spirit Baptist, and a variety of other name Baptists. So roughly of the 4-7 million people who live here, somewhere close to 2 million are Baptist of one kind or another. So, you know, get over it. We just own this place. The Methodists will just have to understand that they have to be more humble than they've been in the past. Not only that, but another common denominator of Baptists during this period is just what I've described. They fought and they split. As a matter of fact, Baptists multiply by dividing. And so, primitive Baptists who were hyper-Calvinist and who did not believe in educated preachers, did not believe in Sunday schools, did not believe in mission societies, did not believe in evangelism, did not believe in revivals, split. And the best evidence of this is our membership from 1838 until when we became a church, until 1845, in what was called the Liberty Baptist Association, which was essentially Chambers County, parts of what was then Macon County, because we weren't Lee County. That's after the Civil War. We were still Macon County. And the Liberty Baptist Association had a number of churches, 40, 50 churches. And you might wonder why it's called Liberty. And the reason it's called Liberty is when it was formed, the primitive Baptist and the missionary Baptist were fighting each other fiercely. And so in order to keep them all together in one association, the associational charter said that we will not engage in the missionary of institutions of our day, but leave churches and members to exercise their judgment in all such cases. Because since primitive Baptists did not believe in missions, why do you try to evangelize if God's already decided who is preordained? It's silly and a waste of time and money. On the other hand, the missionary Baptists were fiercely evangelizing and holding revivals and forming mission societies. And so the agreement of the Liberty Baptist Association was, you have liberty to be a missionary or not be a missionary. We're just not going to talk about it. Well, of course, that didn't last too long, and the missionary Baptist either pulled out or were kicked out by the primitive Baptist. And we left the association, the Liberty Association, in 1845 to help found, with 20 other churches, the Tuskegee Association. Incidentally, connecting us to the wealthy part of the Liberty Association, not the hillbilly part, which was good. We liked that. We wanted to identify with Tuskegee, where all the colleges were. We didn't want to identify with all those hillbillies in Chambers County. At this point, we have a whole series of pastors, and it couldn't be better timing from my standpoint that we found out who our new candidate is going to be, because if you look at the pastors from 1838 until 1862, and incidentally, we had no pastor from 1862 until 1868, story I'll tell you next week as to why that was so. But between 1838 and 1862, we had seven pastors, and the average tenure was 3.5 years, which means our very young 35-year-old preacher, if he is selected next week, will have a tenure at his present church for 1.5 year longer than the average term of all of our pastors from 1838 until 1862. And incidentally, that 3.5 years continues throughout the 19th century. It's true all the way from the end of the Civil War to the beginning of the 20th century. Then we get what we think of as normal terms, which mean 5, 6, 8 years. Jim Evans, 8 years. John Jeffers, 28 years. And we think, well, this is normal. No, this is not normal. This is abnormal. The average term for a Baptist preacher in 2013 is 3 years as pastor of a Baptist church, back to the standards we had before the Civil War. Our second pastor was here very briefly, E.C.D.B. Thomas. Now, I want you all to memorize that, and that's going to be on the final exam. I want the initials E.C.D.B., and I want to tell you how he got his name. He got his name because his mother dreamed. His mother, when she was pregnant, dreamed that he was going to be a Baptist preacher. And when she dreamed this 3 nights in a row, she became convinced that that settled the matter. He was going to be a Baptist preacher. Then she dreamed that she was going to give him a name, and he was going to bear this name all of his life. And finally, on the third night of the dream, she got her husband to wake up because she said, "You've got to write the name down." You will understand why it was urgent that he do so, because she could not otherwise remember it. It was Edwin Champion Baptist Bowler Wheeler Nicholas Dema Stephen Resden Carter Jackson Moore Thomas. Or to put it another way, you only had to memorize, when you learned ECDB, his initials, 1/3 of his actual name in terms of initials. There are actually 12 initials. That is, in my 50 years of reading Baptist history, the longest name in the history of any Baptist minister ever in the history of the world. I want you to go tell your Baptist and Methodist and Presbyterian friends that they can say nah, nah, nah to you all they want, but that we have the Baptist preacher that has the longest name in the history of Baptist theology. Well, it's kind of curious. He was not a particularly well-educated man. And Mary Reese Frazier's History of Auburn First Baptist Church, just an 8-page little history, talks about him in terms of not being, Frazier has this wonderful line. She says, "He was so busy remembering his name that he was a very poor preacher," which I just love. After 1 year, the church did not ask him to sign up for another year. We had only 1-year terms during this period of time. And so there are two pastors in a row. And I want you to note, in light of what I've already told you, the nature of these two pastors. They're both from Georgia, as had been Obadiah Eccles, our first pastor. And in fact, we had a steady stream. That's because the migration patterns in this whole area of Alabama are straight out of Georgia. This is called the Georgia group, and they vie with the South Carolina group up in the Tennessee Valley to control Alabama. So these two pastors are brothers, and they come one after another. It's the only time in First Baptist Church history we've had pastors from the same family in succession. The first one is Elbert Williams, And Elbert Williams, from a very fine family in Edenton, his father was a very wealthy man, and in fact, they owned a cotton manufacturing plant in Savannah, Georgia. This is unusual. Most of the cotton was manufactured in the Midlands of England and Manchester and Liverpool. It was not finished here. And if there were manufacturing textile plants in America, they were mainly in Massachusetts and Connecticut. So we sent all the cotton someplace else because we weren't sure factories had been ordained of God. We knew farmers were, but we weren't sure about factories. So in Savannah, one of these two brothers, the younger one, William Williams, has a very interesting life because he goes to the University of Georgia. He graduates first in his class at the University of Georgia. He goes back down to Savannah to help his father with the mill for a while, trying to decide what he wants to do with his life. And he sees this young woman by the name of Ruth Bell, who's a spinner in the spinning room and comes from a poor white family. And he's taken with her. She has jet black hair. And in fact, Mary Fraser, the author of one of our church's first history, as a matter of fact, is so taken with this love story that 1/8 of her entire history of First Baptist Church is a description of the love story of William Williams and Ruth Bell. And this is the way the story goes. I'm going to shorten it a good deal for you. But he sees this spinning this girl in the spinning room, and she's got this jet black hair, and she's cute as she can be. And he goes up, and he asks her name. She won't tell him. And he finally says, "I'm the son of the owner." And she says, "Ruth Bell." She doesn't ask him his name or who he is or anything about him. She just said, "Ruth Bell." So he goes to her father. And, well, first of all, he brings her books. And it's so funny because Fraser, Mary Fraser, our church historian, wrote, he gave her books that she could understand. Well, that's because there wasn't much she could understand, because spinning room girls generally didn't have any education at all. They were poor whites. So he teaches her essentially how to read, brings her books, and then he goes to her father and says, "I want to court your daughter." And her father said, "No, you cannot court my daughter." Because he couldn't understand what the son of the owner would see in his daughter other than something he didn't want him to see in his daughter that would attract him to her daughter, his daughter. So he said, "No, you can't do this." So he begins to court secretly. And he takes Ruth Bell finally to his parents, and his parents and his sisters say, "You got to be kidding. You're not marrying a cotton mill girl." So he says, "Yeah, we are." So he defies her parents. Then they defy his parents and his sisters. And finally they marry. And he takes her to New York and puts her in school. Can you imagine anybody in Alabama getting to go to school in New York City? But this cotton mill girl goes to school in New York City. He gets a law degree from Harvard. He comes, incidentally, there's a difference here. Historians do disagree. Fraser says he went to Princeton. John Jeffers says he went to Harvard. I think John's right. But at any rate, it's either Princeton or Harvard. Pretty good schools, not bad schools. He comes back. He gets a law degree, goes to Montgomery, opens a law practice in this rapidly growing, incredibly affluent cotton town. But while he's been in New York, he has been converted. And he's become a Christian. And he's even thinking about preaching. So when he comes to Montgomery, he is a lawyer for a while, and then he becomes a bivocational Baptist minister at the Quarter Time First Baptist Church of Auburn, Alabama, called as pastor to replace his brother. His brother is hired to teach ancient languages, that's Greek and Latin primarily, at Mercer University. So he leaves our church, Dale, not to go to another church, but to go to Mercer University, to become a professor of ancient languages and classics. And after his brother was pastor of our church from 3 years, from 1852 to 1855, the brother leaves to teach theology at Mercer University and becomes a renowned theologian and a co-founder in 1859, 4 years after he leaves our church, of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And in fact, one of the most prominent persons in the history of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, where he teaches theology. Yeah, Helen? She came here as his wife. She was our pastor's wife. Had two kids. She got a great education, an incredible education. Smart as she could be. Everybody talks about what a wonderful person she is. And with that amazing story, I'm going to leave you dangling until next week.